Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 27 of the PreparedX Podcast. In this podcast, I interview Jessica Buchanan. For those of you that know about Jessica's story, back in October 25th, actually, of 2011, Jessica and her colleague were kidnapped at gunpoint by Somali land pirates, and they were held for 93 days, enduring the most harrowing and painful experience of their lives. And so we interviewed Jessica about that experience. This is truly a fascinating podcast. Actually, President Obama ordered SEAL Team 6 to attempt a rescue. And on January 25th of the following year, 2012, SEAL Team 6 went in and they killed several of her captors, or actually all of the captors that were in the vicinity. And they managed to airlift Buchanan and her colleague to safety. The story of Jessica has been told on the internet. It's also been on 60 Minutes. And she's also documented her story in a New York Times bestseller called Impossible Odds, The Kidnapping of Jessica Buchanan and Her Dramatic Rescue by SEAL Team 6. So you should certainly check her book out. But this podcast is excellent and goes on. I think she tells her story over about 45 minutes in this podcast. And finally, she mentions this at the end of the podcast, Clint Eastwood will be producing a movie about Jessica's ordeal. So her story has gone to the next level, and there'll be a movie about her ordeal. Truly amazing story. Worth listening to this one right to the very end. I think you'll find it fascinating. Here's Jessica's story. Good morning, Jessica. How are you doing today?
I'm very well, thank you. How about you?
I'm very well, thank you. Just before we get started with the interview, Jessica, for our audience, if you could just introduce yourself and talk for a few moments about your career.
Sure. My name is Jessica Buchanan, and I'm the co-author of the New York Times bestselling book Impossible Odds, which details an interesting, for lack of a better word, experience that I had while working as a humanitarian aid worker in Somalia. I was kidnapped in October of 2011, subsequently held outdoors for 93 days by Somali pirates, and then rescued by the very prestigious SEAL Team 6 in January of 2012. So basically what I do now, I'm a teacher by profession, but I have the wonderful opportunity to get to tell this story, both from an inspirational side and also from a patriotic side, to just share what great things our military is capable of doing and bringing me back here alive and safe and well.
Sure. Fascinating story, and I think our audience are going to be captivated by this interview. So we appreciate you taking the time out today to join us and share your story. And so why don't we start from the beginning then, in terms of where you come from, you know, where you went to school, where you grew up, and then, you know, how that then led into you, you know, getting into the humanitarian work.
Okay. Well, you know, I grew up in the Midwest. I always kind of, it's so funny how our lives just take these interesting journeys, these paths. I grew up outside of Cincinnati, Ohio, and I went to, you know, a really small kind of private school. I grew up in a family that was very committed to social justice, a family very invested in their personal space. And so my parents instilled in me values that were very important to them in terms of doing good for others and for our community. And if we had more than we should give to others who didn't have what they needed. And so I think I kind of took that very seriously, very much to heart, went on to college outside of Philadelphia Valley Forge University, obtained a teaching degree, and in the middle of my educational experience decided, really felt strongly that I wanted to travel abroad and go and teach. So I started in Central America teaching through my summers, and then eventually got over to South Sudan to do some volunteering in orphanages, and then, you know, one step leads you through a door and then another door opens. And right. So I ended up student teaching at an international school in Nairobi, Kenya, and then they offered me a full-time teaching position, which I gladly took. And so I started my teaching career at the Roslyn Academy in Nairobi, Kenya, where I met my husband, Eric Landemalm. He was working in the humanitarian field. He's basically the equivalent of a human rights lawyer from Sweden. So we met and started dating. And about a year and a half later, we got married, and he had moved up and was based in the northern part of Somalia. So I moved up there with him, and I just started volunteering, teaching English lessons, consulting a little bit, and ended up getting a full-time position with the Danish Demining Group, which was a really interesting group because they were working in the areas of community safety and armed violence reduction, which was something that I had a very personal interest in. And even through my college experience and my training, had gotten very involved in this whole phenomenon of advocating for the rights of child soldiers and kind of just trying to educate people in the States about this whole plight of these kids that were forced to fight in these militias. And so that married very well into my position as an education advisor for the Danish Demining Group. And so I carried on in that role for a couple of years until October 25th, 2011.
Sure. So talk us through, you know, working in those environments like the northern part of Somalia you just mentioned there. You know, talk us about, you know, how, what are some of the challenges around, you know, working in those types of environments? And are there other environments outside of Somalia that you worked in as well? And Kenya can be quite tough as well. I've spent, you know, some time there myself a long time ago. So what were the challenges for you for working in those tough environments?
You know, there are professional challenges and there are financial challenges. I mean, it runs the whole gamut. But you know, you're in a place like Somalia, which is it's like on the index of quality of life. I think it ranks zero. Like it doesn't even rank. I mean, people are just trying, to survive. And I mean that in the most basic sense. You know, it's about clean water. It's about food, some sort of shelter. I mean, people, for the most part, are living very primitive. They're a nomadic culture, so they're moving constantly. So, you know, you have to get past those issues to get to the point where you can start talking about the violence and how to protect their children and how to teach the children to protect themselves and each other in terms of firearms that are present in the home and explosives that they're picking up that have been left over from civil wars. I've worked in South Sudan and northern Uganda, Rwanda. And many of the challenges are very much the same. You have corruption in the government that makes it hard to get anywhere in terms of development or aid or assistance. And, you know, it was just kind of incremental and minutial. You know, you just every day do what you can do. And I always carried on this philosophy that I wasn't called to be successful. I was called to be faithful. And so I just did what I knew was the right thing to do and hoped that it would, help somebody at some point somewhere someday. You know, maybe me doing my job, there would be one kid that wouldn't get his arm blown off because he would remember our education session that we brought into his village, and so then he wouldn't pick up that unexploded ordnance that he saw laying out under a tree outside of his community. You know, just things like those. You know, you just have to be committed and really trust that you know, you're doing what you're supposed to be doing. So it's tough. It's a tough environment.
Yeah, amazing cause. So I commend you for that. The ability to go out into those environments and then the work on top of that, you know, the environment itself. Mm-hmm. So it's really great stuff. And so as we leading up to those early moments in October, those first few days leading up to the kidnapping itself, was there anything, you know, that you found that was unusual as you look back now? Obviously, you've had a lot of time over the years to kind of dwell on that, and you probably had time over the 93 days that you were in captivity to dwell on, you know, was there anything out of the ordinary in terms of what you saw and your environment and the awareness around you? You know, what were the circumstances leading up to the kidnapping?
Well, you know, I had scheduled this training. I was based in Hargeisa, Somaliland, and then I would travel around in the East African region that I manage those programs. And this was my first visit to Galkayo, to the southern part of Puntland, or, you know, the northern part of Somalia. And, you know, I mean, we all know, especially when you're working in these regions, security, I mean, you take security very seriously. You have to look at it in a completely different way than you do, than I do now in my, like, more regular later life. And I think it's easy to get kind of desensitized because you're hearing about things that are happening all the time. And you're also putting your trust in other people who are advisors, or their jobs are to, you know, as much as they can ensure the environment, you know, daily situation, and whether or not to evaluate whether or not it's safe enough for you to go in. I had scheduled this training twice before and canceled it due to some security hiccups or things that were going on. And I did feel like a little bit of, whether it was my own personal pressure or outside pressure, to like go in and get this training done because this was, you know, part of my job. And I didn't really want to go. I just didn't feel good about it. My husband didn't feel good about it, but it was one of those things, I think, when you're working in these kind of environments and in this kind of job, you just like got to go in and get it done and get out and it'll all be fine. Like, chances are 99% of the time, everything's fine. And so I got down there to the field office, and just really, like, my intuition, like, I'm really big on listening to our intuition.
Yes.
And whatever that means, you know, for people in business, whether it's security, whatever it is, whether it's, like, not going to meet that person for dinner because something is just, like, not sitting right, and it just wasn't sitting right with me. But I felt like, you know, I'm a professional. I have a job to do. I want to be taken seriously. And so I just kept, like, pushing that intuition that was screaming at me, pushing it down. And, I mean, it was so loudly screaming at me that when I got to the field office for a couple of days and did, a training in the field office, and then had to the next couple of days, I had to go across the Green Line into another region that was, you know, transporting can be risky and whatnot. I actually had a dream that the night before we had to leave the field office that we had been kidnapped.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Only in my dream, right, it was that our compound had been taken over. Like, I hadn't actually left, and, you know, whatever. And I remember sitting on my bed that morning before I was leaving the office, like, thinking, do I want to do this?
Right.
And then I just dismissed it. And I think that, you know, that can get, like, that whole concept of intuition can get really, like, muddled, and it's very in personal and interpretive. But I think in terms of security, like, you have to listen to yourself.
Yep.
You know, and no one knows better than your gut if you're going to be okay or not. And it was one of my greatest life lessons that I have to listen to my gut. And so, you know, we went on, we conducted the staff training. It all went well. It was all fine. I think it was hard for me to see any kind of markers because I wasn't in my home office. This wasn't a post. So I was relying on other people.
Yep.
You know, because it was all new to me. It was all different. I didn't know what regular procedures were, what the norm was. So I had to rely on other people. And as it would turn out, you know, there were probably signs that other people should have been paying attention to, but just didn't notice because you get caught up in your day-to-day, sure, you know, routines or whatever. So, yeah.
So talk to us about the events of the actual day of the kidnapping then. And then it was October 11th of 2011. If you could just, you know, that particular day, and you've spoken about the lead up to that over the last, you know, the few days leading up to that, and your mm-hmm. intuition and your gut feeling, and but actually on the day and the actual kidnapping itself, if you could just go over that for us, that would be great.
Yeah. So we had left, we had two offices. We had one in North Del Cayo and one in South Del Cayo, and there's this like a boundary line in the middle that's kind of like a safe zone, and we left the north office in a convoy of three vehicles, had to stop at the green line and then cross over by foot and get into a convoy of another three vehicles that were licensed to drive in the southern part. So we did that without any hitch. That was fine. Got to the south office. I had my staff training with my educational staff. You know, I mean, it took like 5-6 hours. It was a full, you know, fairly full working day. And around 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we were waiting for our convoy to come back to take us back to the green line. So we were going to follow the same procedures. And the security advisor, it was a local Somali guy, was on the phone coordinating, and something had been held up. So we had to wait a little bit longer. And finally we got the go ahead to get in the vehicle. And so my colleague Paul that was taken with me was in the front passenger side on the left because the steering wheel was on the right side. And I was right behind him on the left in the passenger seat. And the security advisor was sitting next to me. And we leave the compound and we start driving through town, maybe 5-7 minutes, something like that. Full of bright sun, just a really nice day. I'm not, you know, I'm thinking, okay, we got through that. Like, I'm heading home tomorrow. I'm texting my husband, you know, just like not even looking out the window, not paying attention. And suddenly somebody comes up and cuts us off on the right side and splashes mud up all over the windows and the windshields, and we can't see out of the car. I'm thinking like, oh my gosh, what a jerk. Who drives like that? And then I hear the crack of the butt of AKs on our windows and our windshields, and there's a lot of screaming and a lot of shouting, and the security advisor's door gets pulled open, and there's a very angry Somali man dressed in SPU, like specialized police uniform clothing, and he's screaming in Somali, and he pulls the security advisor out, and I remember him slapping him and hitting him on the head and pulling him out, and he crawls into the vehicle next to me, and he puts an AK to my head, and starts screaming at the driver to drive, and we just take off through town. You know, these roads are not smooth, they're not paved, but we get to the edge of town and take off down just these rutted camel tracks. They're not even real roads, and I mean, we're like up on two wheels on one side. I don't even know how fast we're going, and Paul, my colleague, is begging the driver, you know, slow down, we're gonna die in a car accident, you're gonna kill us, you know, you're gonna kill us. And I'm just thinking, as this is going on, I just have two very basic, very fundamental thoughts. And the first one was, this is so bad. I mean, I can't believe this is happening, whatever this is. It is so bad. And then the second one was that however this turns out, whatever this is, whatever this incident is, my life has changed forever. Like, it's never going to be the same after this.
Right.
And so we drive for hours, and, you know, the sun goes down, and we stop. And at some point, and we're out in the middle of the desert, I can tell we're going south, which is a really bad thing because we don't know what's happening. We don't know who's taken us. We're fearful that it's Al-Shabaab, the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group. If it's Al-Shabaab, then I know I'm fairly sure I'm not going to survive the night.
Right.
My American passport is in the back of the car.
Did you still have, did they remove your cell phones at this point?
Yes, they'd taken our phones. We had a sat phone. They took our personal mobile phones, wallets, money, jewelry. Everything had been removed by this point.
And how many other vehicles did they have in the convoy?
I don't really know because, to be honest, I was too afraid to turn around and look around. I mean, I had a gun to my head the whole time. And I remember driving and we would stop and they would get out and then other people would get in the vehicles. We would drive for a few more hours. They would stop. They'd force us out of the vehicle. We'd get in other vehicles, change, directions. We did this multiple times until maybe 7-8 hours into the whole ordeal. We stopped out in the middle of the desert, just total pitch black. And they told us to get out and to walk out into the desert. And I'm thinking, I'm not going out there. Your mind at this point is just you can't even put one thought in front of the other. I mean, it's just, but all I knew was I'm not going out there. So I started refusing and I got into this verbal, exchange with one of the guys and he was getting very angry with me, but I kept refusing. And finally my colleague Paul comes over to me and he just says, Jessica, we have to walk. So we do, we start walking deep into the desert at this point. And I don't know how long we walked, maybe 20, maybe 30 minutes. And then basically what they did was force us down onto our knees. And it was kind of like a mock execution. We thought we were going to be executed, but they just told us to lay down and sleep. So we just laid there on the ground for hours, not knowing what was going to happen next. And that's kind of... that was the start of the 93 days.
Incredible, incredible what you've been through. So I appreciate you. I know it's sometimes difficult, the sound of your voice going back over the story, but we really appreciate you telling the story here. You're in captivity, 3 months, 90 plus days, 93 days, and, while you're there in captivity, what are some of the biggest challenges for you, and how did you kind of get through that both mentally and physically?
I think the biggest challenge, there were obviously several, but I was taken with Paul, who is a 60-year-old man. He obviously had his own set of challenges, but being a woman in this kind of situation where you are just surrounded by men the entire time, sometimes as little as 6, sometimes as many as 30. I had to be on guard and try to protect myself.
Yep.
With whatever little means I had. My first fear, of course, was always that, I was going to be killed, but my second fear was that I'd be sexually assaulted.
Sure.
And how would I deal with that? How do I go and, every couple of days I get a bottle of water to wash myself with. So, trying to find some privacy, but how do you figure all of that out in this very extreme circumstance that no one ever thinks they're going to find themselves in. It was so funny because it's, your instincts do just really take over because your body and your mind want to survive, whether you know it or not, because that's how we're wired. That's how we're made. And I remember a couple, it was the second or third night we had been thrown into the vehicles, this convoy of vehicles in the middle of the night. And we were felt like we were kind of running from something. I don't know if the local authorities had located us or if they thought the American military was after us, but we were running from something. And, they had separated Paul and I into two different vehicles, and I was just out of my mind with panic because I was afraid one of us was going to be taken and sold to someone else, or, I would never see him again. I didn't know what was happening. And I was so scared that I became physically ill, and I made them stop the car, and I got out of the car, and I was sick. And the head of the group at this time, a man named Abdi, he got out, and he, you know, asked me if, I don't know, if I wanted something to drink or, you know, whatever. And out of the blue, he just asked me if I had children. And at the time I didn't, but I, out of my mouth, I just said, yeah, I have a 1-year-old baby boy. And he was like, oh, you know, I have however many kids and whatnot. And so he started chatting to me about my kids. And so I made up this whole long story about my baby, and I gave him the name of my dog. Eric and I had this mutt dog in Somalia named Smulan. And so I was thinking, like, if they use this for negotiations, Eric would know and he could play along with it. But I didn't realize it at the time, but as it played out, telling them that I was a mother, I think, put me in another category. Right. I went from being like this young single woman to being a mother.
Yep.
And, you know, in that kind of culture, mothers are respected.
Yep.
And they're revered. And I think that moved me from being kind of like an object to being almost like a person.
Right.
And I think that really kind of protected me in some ways, because I would bring up my baby all the time and talk about my baby and being a mother and just trying to get them to see me in that light. And I think that protected me a lot. Obviously, you know, the thing I had to battle the most was my own mind.
Sure.
You know, I mean, I talk a lot. I travel around a lot and talk about, you know, how do you sit there for 93 days with nothing? No pen, no pencil, weeks of solitary confinement where you don't even open your mouth and you lose your voice because you haven't used your vocal cords in so long. Like, how do you manage to stay sane through all of that? And I think for me, it was imperative to stay positive. And it's really hard in that kind of situation to figure out a way to stay positive. But once you figure it out and stick with it, it really does work. And so what I did was I decided I had all this time. I didn't know how much time I had, but I was 32 years old when this happened, and I'd had a really beautiful life up until then. And so I made like a work plan for myself. I made it very organized. And so every day I took 1 year of my life and I just tried to remember everything, like every single minuscule detail I could remember. Wow. About that year in my life. So like when I was 6 years old, my mom, I was growing up in the Midwest. We were in Southern Indiana at that time. It was a hot July summer night. My mom took me to the movie theater for the first time. And so I went to go see Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, and she had this beautiful blue sundress on and had white flowers and the popcorn. What did it taste like? And what were the seats like in the theater? And what was like, I replayed the whole movie that I'd seen a million times since then. Like, so, I mean, just like getting into every single little detail. And that brought up a lot of, you know, wow, why did this happen? And why were things like this? And a lot of reflection and a lot of processing. I'd lost my mother a year before the kidnapping happened. So I was very much like in the middle of grieving her still. And so it was actually, and I mean, it seems funny to say this now, but at that time, and I can say this 5 years later after I've processed through a lot of the trauma of it, it was really a gift to be able to do that, because I don't think that we in our normal lives get the chance, the opportunity to do something like that. And I kind of came to the realization that, you know, they had my body confined, but my mind was mine to do with what I wanted. It was actually really free.
Right.
And so, you know, that carried me through. And so when I remembered everything I could remember, I then started to dream, and I would just dream about the future and what I wanted to do when I got out, because I knew I was going to get out. I knew I was going to survive. I was going to make it through this. And I didn't have any children yet, but I knew I wanted them. And so, you know, how Eric and I were going to change our lives so that we could become parents, and what we were going to do next and stuff. So it was actually a really beautiful time.
It's incredible the way you look at that. And like you said, looking back is always, you know, when you've had the time to look back and process it, that's wonderful. Was there any communication in terms of a negotiation at any time that you were aware of while you were, you know, in captivity?
Yeah. I mean, I'd say a week into the whole ordeal, this character came onto the scene named Jibril, and he kept calling himself a translator. We kept thinking he was the negotiator. I think now he was probably one of the masterminds behind the whole thing, but he spoke English, and so he was really the only person we could communicate with. So he would, you know, I don't know how true it was, but he would, you know, come back and tell us how much they were asking for, and allude to how much our people were offering. And, you know, the beginning negotiations started at $45 million, which was just like,
wow,
ludicrous.
Right.
And I think that our beginning offering was somewhere around $20,000. So I was kind of like banging my head against the wall, like a proverbial wall, like thinking, you know, like, how do you even, there's nowhere to go from there.
Right. There's no meeting in the middle, for sure, right?
Yeah, I mean, and that's when I started understanding. I think that's like the crucial thing for people to understand. If, God forbid, they find themselves or their family members in a situation like this, these things take a really, really long time.
Yeah.
Like years to sort out. You know, I was thinking in the beginning, oh, we're aid workers. You know, we have a presence in the community. We're helping the community. You know, this thing will be figured out in the matter of weeks, you know, 2 weeks tops. And then like weeks turned into months. And I thought, and then I started realizing, oh, okay, you know, like this, we're in it for the long haul, and we're going to have to figure out how we're going to survive. I mean, these things take years to solve. And so every time, you know, there was a couple of guys, I could never figure out exactly who was the head of what, but another man named Hassan, he would come out, and I think he was behind most of it, if he was financing it or what, I'm not sure. But, you know, every time he came out and he was really angry, we knew negotiations were not going well.
Right.
And, you know, you understand when you're sitting there, and then, of course, getting out and being filled in on how things are going on the outside. I mean, you can't offer a huge jump in money when you're negotiating. Like, this thing has to go, there's a procedure, there's a precedent to follow in terms of, I mean, I think it's pretty much all the same. Like, it's just small increments, and there has to be, you know, proof of life calls and what it takes to get a proof of life call. You know, we drive 6-7 hours out into the middle of the desert and in the middle of the night and answer a series of questions, and then the phone's taken from you and you have no idea if that's what they wanted, or, you know, I mean, it's just, you're just completely in the dark all the time.
Just amazing to, you know, to hear what you've been through, and to tell the story here for our audience, that they're certainly going to be captivated about this, and I'm sure those of that have not read the book will certainly be looking for it, and we'll obviously add the links at the bottom of the podcast so people can read the rest of the story. Talk to us a little bit now. You know, everybody loves to hear, you know a great ending, and obviously you're still here with us, and so obviously this did end, and it ended okay in the after the 93 days. But talk to us about the rescue. Talk to us about how SEAL Team 6 came in, and you know, I've certainly listened to some of the I think your 60 Minutes interview about that side of it, and that part of the story, you know, is really interesting. So, you know, if you could talk us through that.
Sure. Well, it was, I mean, 92 days into the ordeal, and unfortunately for me, I had gotten extremely sick. I had gotten a really bad urinary tract infection from the, you know, the lack of hygiene and just the sanitation. And, you know, we were held outside the entire time. So it was turning into a kidney infection because they wouldn't bring a doctor. They wouldn't give me the right antibiotics. And I needed to be in a hospital. I needed an IV. I mean, it was starting to get really bad. And January 16th, 2012, I had my last proof of life call with our family communicator, and I told her, you know, I think I'm going to die out here. I'm trying to stay positive, but I'm telling you, I am very, very ill, and I need help. I need a medical facility and a doctor. And so somebody's got to do something really soon. And so, you know, I didn't have much hope or expectation that anything was going to come out of that. So I just carried on. And January 24th, I needed help kind of getting to my mat. We would sit under trees during the day and then have to carry our mat out into the middle of the field at night. And so Paul was allowed to help me carry my mat out. And I, you know, lay down, and usually would fall asleep around 6:30 when the sun would go down. And I was in a lot of pain. I was feeling very sick that night. And I woke up in the middle of the night ill, needing to be sick. And I stood up and I said the word toilet, which was my way of asking permission to leave my mat. And everybody, there were 9 guys on the ground that night, and everybody was completely passed out, which was very strange. Because usually there was at least one person keeping guard. So go through this whole thing. Finally, I have to leave, but I have a small flashlight in my hand, like a pen light. So I kept flashing it so that they would know I was there, that I hadn't tried to escape. And when I finally come back to my mat, I got myself all situated in my blanket, but I could hear this scratching noise, and like something like these big beetles would come out in the middle of the night. And I just, you know, I'm sick, I'm in pain, I'm so tired, I'm just so weary, and I'm just not in the mood for any of this. I get up, I'm like shaking my blanket, can't find these beetles, lay back down, I keep hearing the scratching noise, everybody's still passed out. And about 60 seconds later, the pirate on the left of me stands up, and he starts like whisper screaming at everybody to get up, and he's holding an AK, and then the night just erupts into gunfire. And I throw the blanket over my face and get down to the ground as low as I possibly can, because I know that I don't know who this is or what's happening, but I know my instincts are telling me to get down, stay down as low as I can so I don't get caught in crossfire. And I'm just hearing horrific things around me, and somebody starts grabbing my shoulders and my legs and shaking me. And I'm trying to fight back as much as I can. And the blanket's pulled down from my face, and I can't see anything. It's a very dark night. There was no moon. There were no stars that night. And I can kind of make out these black masks, and I'm just shaking and screaming and fighting back. And then I hear my name, this young American guy. He sounds just like my brother, and he just says, Jessica, it's okay. We're here. We're the American military. You're safe now. We're going to take you home. And he helps me sit up, and I'm starting to make out these figures in the darkness, and I'm just in total and utter shock. And all I can say over and over again is, you're American? You're American? Like, I just can't, like, put it together. Like, how, I just can't figure it out. And so I can't find my shoes. Someone picks me up and throws me over his shoulder. We just like take off running through all of this, whatever it is, off to a place of safety in the middle of the desert. And of course, my first question is, did my colleague Paul, did he make it out okay? And he's sitting right there, and he had been talking to a few of the guys, and he leans over to me and he says, Jessica, do you know who these guys are? You know, this is SEAL Team 6. These are the guys that got Bin Laden. And I'm just, you know, my mind is just, I can't put two thoughts together. And so we sit like that, and we wait until the helicopters come in, and basically they just carried us out of there. I mean, it was the most surreal, incredible experience of my lifetime.
Wow, that's just amazing. From the time when the gunfire started to getting on the helicopter, what was that time frame? Do you know?
I don't know. I mean, I would say an hour and a half, maybe something
right.
like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not long.
Sure.
Not long, but long enough.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. That's just incredible. Thanks for sharing that. Just as we start to wrap up, you know, again, over the last 5 years, you've probably had a lot of time to process this. You've obviously put your thoughts mm-hmm. and your experience down into a book. And I believe, you know, there might be even a movie coming out soon. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, we have just optioned the book Impossible Odds to Warner Brothers, and it's currently in development with Clint Eastwood. So his production company, Malpaso, is producing it, and the script is currently being adapted from the book by Brian Hegland, who also wrote scripts for LA Confidential and Mystic River. So we're hoping to be in pre-production within the next few months. And I mean, again, it's another surreal experience to even think about that or say that out loud. But it's just the whole thing has been an incredible journey. So.
What have you learned about yourself, about being in this situation, in terms of something that was, you know, totally out of your control? You know, are there any life lessons for yourself that you can share with our audience?
I think we're stronger than we ever thought we possibly could be. And the reason we go through struggles like this is so that we can see that. And, you know, I remember saying to Paul one morning very early on, you know, like, I am not this girl. Like, I did not go into humanitarian work because I'm hardcore and because I wanted to prove myself and all of these things. I this is not me. And several months later, I remember waking up one morning, sitting around the fire and saying to him, you know what, I think I'm hardcore now. Like, I think I... I think I am that girl. And, you know, I am grateful now that I had the opportunity to see, the depths of, survival
right.
that humans have. And we all have it. I believe very strongly that we're all surviving something, we will survive it, or we have survived something. And you know, I'm just grateful that I can tell the story.
Fantastic. Well, this has just been a terrific episode, and I'm really pleased you had time to join us today, Jessica. Our audience is certainly going to be captivated by this. So thank you. Do you have any final comments as well? You know, where might the our audience, if they want to get a copy of your book, where would they be able to find that, you know, to get more information about your story?
Impossible Odds is sold anywhere books are sold, and you can get it on Amazon, of course, too.
Yes.
So. And I'll be looking forward to sharing more with you all in April.
Yes, that's right. So for our audience, those of you that don't know, Jessica will be speaking at the International Crisis Management Conference, and she'll be our keynote speaker on April 5th of this year, 2017. So we're really excited to, first of all, meet you in Boston at the Aloft Seaport Hotel. And obviously, we're super excited for you to be there to share your story for all our, you know, all our members, everyone that comes along to the conference. And hopefully, you'll bring some books along as well. And I think you're going to be doing a book signing while you're there as well.
Absolutely. Yep. I'll look forward to meeting everybody and having some good conversation then.
Great. Okay, Jessica. Well, again, thanks, and have a wonderful day. And we'll
Thank
see you soon.
You.
Take care.
Take care.
Yep. Bye.
Okay. Bye.